Radiolab is supported by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Radiolab is supported by the John Templeton Foundation, funding research and catalyzing conversations that inspire people with awe and wonder. Learn about the researchers making the latest discoveries in the science of well-being, complexity, forgiveness, and free will at templeton.org/podcast.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Wait, you're listening.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
You're listening to Radiolab.
Radiolab.
From
WNYC.
See?
Yeah.
Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab. And today, we're doing a show about bugs.
That's right.
Bugs. Insects.
These are adorable bugs in their own creepy, horrible, crawling, and annoying way.
Right. But the thing that distinguishes the two bugs at the center of the two stories we're going to tell is that they have done damage on such a level that they transcend other bugs.
That's right.
They are transcendently annoying.
And we have to begin with everyone's perennial favorite, of course.
The mosquito. And here to tell us why is producer Andy Mills.
Okay, so a while back I was talking with author Sonia Shaw.
I've had a very fraught relationship with mosquitoes for a long time.
She actually wrote a book about malaria and mosquitoes
called The Fever.
And for her, it all really started when she was a kid.
Well, I grew up visiting India every summer because my family's from there. All my cousins, all my grandparents, they were all there.
Summer vacations.
Summer vacations in India with my cousins. All I wanted to do was fit in.
But the mosquitoes would always call her out.
They knew.
There was a Yankee in the group.
They would just focus on me. And so they wouldn't bite my cousins. They would be totally unscathed and I would be like covered in welts. I ended up having to sleep under a mosquito net, which is even more kind of isolating under this like suffocating net.
She says at night when mosquitoes would land on her net, she would think,
I hate you. I hate you. But at the same time, I'm not allowed to do anything to them.
And here's when you get to the fraught part, because Sonia and her family belong to this religion called Jain Dharma.
It's kind of an extreme nonviolent philosophy. You're not supposed to eat meat, obviously. You're not even supposed to eat any root vegetables because then you're killing the whole plant. Mm-hmm. You're not supposed to walk on grass because if you walk on grass, you can kill little insects. When you pray, you're supposed to wear a mask so you don't breathe in any like microbes or insects and inadvertently kill them. So I have to act like I'm totally cool with the mosquitoes around me.
But every so often, Sonia says,
I would see a mosquito land near me. And when I thought no one was looking, I would just sort of mush it with my hand. And I still can feel like that tingly feeling on my hand just telling you that story. That tiny body being crushed by my hand, I mean, it makes me feel terrible.
And Sonia's ambivalence toward the mosquito, it has stayed with her her entire life pretty much, because on the one hand, she knows that mosquitoes have gotten a bad rap.
First of all,
they don't really want to suck your blood.
They don't want to risk their lives to get a blood meal. It's the most dangerous thing they're ever going to do because it's so easy for us to kill them. On top of that, when they fill up with your blood, that blood is several times heavier than their own body weight. So suddenly they're full of this stuff and they can't fly very well anymore.
And on top of that, the only mosquitoes that bite you are the ladies.
And the only reason they do it is because of all the protein in blood, and they use that to nourish their eggs.
If they didn't have the protein in that blood, nearly all their babies would die.
So they're really only doing, they're not even doing it for food, you know?
So every bite is just good mommying, really.
You could say that.
We have to just put out the message that when you're being swarmed by mosquitoes biting you, that you're just being swarmed by good ladies who are just nurturing. That might just change the attitude.
I do not fail to appreciate the charm of the mommy mosquito. Good. But on the other hand, think of all the misery they have caused human beings.
There's good estimates that get bandied around that one half of all human deaths since the Stone Age have been due to malaria.
Whoa.
One half
of all human deaths since the Stone Age. So it's had a huge, huge impact on our species. We know this.
And for me, this is not just some like faraway, sad statistical abstraction, right? Like, you know, I used to live and work in Sudan. And while I was there, I saw the children's wards at the clinics and the hospitals. Like, I saw the kids dying of this disease, all from a mosquito. And kind of where I'm headed with this is that, like, I mean, could this be the creature that we can all agree that we should just get rid of?
You can hope for that, Andy, but it's not going to happen because mosquitoes are incredibly fertile. You could make a little groove on a rainy day in the mud, and they will have babies in that little patch of water.
It's like a baby party.
They're like a baby
in a footstep.
Party. Exactly. So there's no
Well, remember, mosquitoes, you know, they reproduce really fast. A typical mosquito only lives for like a week or so. So many, many, many generations are evolving as we're throwing chemicals at them. And as soon as one evolves some way to withstand it a little bit better, that little creature sort of sweeps its genes throughout the population. And that happens within like a few years. Like, so 3, 5, 7 years is kind of the time horizon for when you start using a chemical against a mosquito to when the mosquito population becomes resistant to it.
Wow.
It's a problem.
But, what if I told you that we had gotten to the point where we could solve this problem?
Oh, you'll have to show me an example.
Oh, that would make me so happy to show you.
Wow.
I sent reporter David Baker down to this small town in eastern Brazil to check out this factory.
And here is mosquito factory. And just as we come in, a woman with a kind of electric tennis racket is killing an insect on the wall.
A mosquito factory?
Yeah, it sounds strange, but the world's largest mosquito factory is in Brazil.
This is Hayden Perry,
Chief Executive Officer of Oxitec.
And by factory, he means that this is a place where people actually breed mosquitoes. A very special kind.
I think at the moment they're making about 4 million or so a week.
Bom dia.
After you pass through a couple of airlocks, you enter this massive room.
It's a huge concrete warehouse.
Where there are rows and rows of buckets. How this works is that Hayden and his company in England, they will send the factory workers here a batch of eggs.
And then we remove the eggs and put it all in a water. I am Aldo Malavasi, director of the Medfly Mosquito Facility in Brazil.
And inside
each of these buckets,
what's that, a gram?
How many? Quanto aqui?
Inside is 80,000 eggs. Yeah. And they look like they're just tiny, tiny little black dots.
Para chegar na fase de pupa, 8 dias.
8 dias. After you put the eggs, in about half hour to 1 hour, they start to hatch. And then we have a small larvae.
And now you can see lots of, this is larva. These are larva, lots of mosquito larva swimming in the water. Whoa.
They look like long, translucent worms with spikes all over their bodies.
If someone said put your hand in there, I'm not sure if I would.
He's beautiful.
Now, according to Hayden, when these mosquitoes grow up and become adults, they will look
completely indistinguishable from normal mosquitoes, except that they carry this lethal gene.
Hayden's company has actually put a tiny little extra special, extra deadly gene inside their bodies. Which
so here,
you can actually see. At a certain point in David's trip, one of the factory workers, they brought over this special UV light and they shined it over the larva.
Oh, goodness me. It's like something from Alien. It's like wiggling larva that is full of these kind of globules that are glowing red, like from inside its body. Those are the genes that are glowing?
Yes.
Wow.
Hayden and his company, they have genetically engineered this glowing red gene so that when it turns on,
It actually produces a certain protein.
Inside of these mosquitoes, the gene starts cranking out these proteins more and more and more and more until the cell basically goes
out of control. And the insect dies.
This is the evil genius part. They turn off this gene temporarily. Then, in another room in the factory,
okay,
they hatch the babies, grow the mosquitoes in these test tubes.
Thousands, perhaps, of these plastic tubes. Inside are mosquitoes, loads of them.
Then they separate
pup females and males.
Females and males, okay.
Then they take just the males.
Put the males into little pots.
They take the pots out into cities and towns, and every few hundred feet,
they shake these pots out
and release the mosquitoes into the wild.
Those males, they go out there, they are just tuned in to finding females.
Remember, those are the ones that bite.
They tune into the wing beat, and off they go, find a female. They're satisfying the biological urge to mate.
Then the female will go off and lay her eggs. The eggs will hatch. And then inside each and every one of those little babies, the gene will turn on. They'll start pumping out those proteins. The cell goes out of control.
And larvae will die before they become functioning adults. So instead of that female laying 100 eggs at a time or up to 500 in their lifetime, she lays the same number, but they die. To give an example of the last trial, they were working in a town called Mandacaru, about 3,000 people there.
Mandacaru is this small town in Brazil that's had a really terrible time with the disease that the mosquitoes spread there called dengue fever, which can make you
feel as if your bones are breaking.
And it can sometimes cause
bleeding from the eyes or ears.
And in kids, death. In the past decade, what you've seen is cases of dengue going up and up and up.
Yeah.
But in 2011,
they started releasing our males.
All across town, they released these mutant males. And then they waited.
And within about 6 months, they reduced the population of the mosquitoes by 96%.
Wow! 96%?
Yeah, in that town. So in 6 months, you pretty much eliminated the mosquito population.
And this wasn't just some one-off thing, because the next year, after the rainy season,
instead of seeing that massive explosion of mosquito numbers, which you get every single year, you didn't see any increase at all.
Wow.
Because there wasn't a population there to build up.
And this is just the beginning.
In Brazil, there's been a series of trials.
In a bunch of different places.
They're all over 90%.
As in 90% of the population was killed in the first round. And they've released them in different parts of the Cayman Islands.
And again, that was the same idea. We had over 90% reduction.
They're starting their first trials in Panama. They're in talks with local government officials in India, Malaysia, and the USA.
Yeah.
Can we just think about what would the world look like without mosquitoes?
I mean, California. There's hardly any mosquitoes there. It would be like California everywhere. Huh. That would be totally awesome.
Both of you are acting like the only thing that happens with these animals is they make humans, and particularly human children, sick.
It's not them. It's the parasite.
Right.
But they're the ones who are spreading it. And so if our idea is you stop the mosquito, you stop the malaria, then I've been really...
You might stop a few other things. That's all I'm saying. Just call David.
So we did. That's a really good mosquito impression, actually.
Is that David?
That's David.
Oh, we called David.
I'm David Quammen. I'm a science writer based in Bozeman, Montana.
The reason that Robert wanted us to call him this time is because a long, long time ago,
many, many, many years ago,
David wrote an article for Outside Magazine
titled Sympathy for the Devil
that wrestled with the following question.
What, if anything, are the redeeming merits of the mosquito? These critters have a lot to answer for, but is that the whole story? Should we therefore dismiss them?
Or destroy them?
Or destroy them, eradicate them.
Did you come up with things to say about this?
Well, wasn't easy, but I did, yeah. I read, and...
And while he read, he said he did turn up some interesting facts. For example, there is this mosquito that lives up in the Arctic.
Aedes nigripes.
Which,
pollinates Arctic orchids and spreads no disease to anybody.
Which is nice, but then... David made the following argument.
Because of their pestiferous disease vectoring,
Pestiferous disease vectoring. Whoa.
They have made tropical forest very, very difficult for humans to inhabit, to colonize over the last 10,000 years.
Because every time that we would try and go into those forests, we would get swarmed by mosquitoes and we'd run away.
And therefore, they have played an important role in bringing those forests forward relatively intact into the 20th and 21st centuries. If there were no difficulties, diseases, threats to the people living in those forests, then those forests would have been turned into settlements, cities, farmlands, much more extensively and much earlier than they have been and are now being. I call them nature's Viet Cong because they are the resistance fighters on behalf of the rainforest.
Why don't we make it harder for you? Why don't we make you imagine that it's springtime or early summer in Alaska, that there's tundra melting everywhere, that there are hordes and hordes and clouds of mosquitoes, and they're forming a permanent sort of cloud around you. And then Andy Mills comes up and offers you the opportunity to eliminate them completely from the planet. And he makes this offer as they are stabbing you in the wrist, face, cheek, and ear. Would do what, say?
I would do these two things. First, I would unzip the mosquito net of the tent, and I would say, Andy, for God's sake, let's have this conversation in the tent. And we would jump in the tent, zip that thing.
Okay, that's
now true. I'd say, okay, now, Andy, we can think about this clearly. And one of the things I'd say was, well, look, if we're up here, just two humans in the middle of this Alaskan tundra, and there are these millions and millions of mosquitoes swarming around us to get our blood, obviously, we're a small factor on this landscape, and they're a big factor in some way. So if we were to press a button and eradicate them instantly, it's very difficult to know their load-bearing significance in the ecosystem because they're playing lots of different roles as parasites, as competitors, as prey.
But one of the things that Sonia Shaw told me is that they actually don't play a big role in the ecosystem.
I mean, I really tried hard when I was writing this book to get a mosquito biologist to explain to me that mosquitoes were useful, that they had some sort of ecological role to play that was important. And no one would admit that they had any role at all. They're not a useful nutrition for bats or fish or any of the other like predators of mosquitoes because their biomass is so small that, you know, those creatures would be fine without mosquitoes. Like everyone would be fine without mosquitoes.
She might be right about that, but that's not the only ecological dimension we're talking about. That does
not
prove.
What other dimension might there be as a for example?
Competition. They might be competing with other insects, and if you eliminate the mosquitoes, then suddenly filaria flies become much more abundant.
Oh.
I mean, when you talk about trying to foresee the consequences of completely eradicating any one species, we just don't know.
The real deep thought here is, if you're going to destroy, the only obligation you owe to yourself is to know what you're killing.
Absolutely. And by that I mean, yes, to know absolutely the dimensions, the implications of what you're doing.
And what I'm weighing on here, Kwaman, is that I too have been to some of these sub-Saharan parts of Africa, and I just was floored that we have a curable disease and how many like 12, 13, 14-year-old kids were hauled up in this world, you know? Like,
I agree with you that that's urgently compelling and important. And I feel the same way, that something needs to be done. And it's true to some extent.
In the end, after all the debate, I've ended up at this kind of middle ground.
Well, I think what we'll aim to do, actually.
Hayden Perry put it to me like this. We don't have to kill them all everywhere. And in fact, maybe we shouldn't. But we can kill them where we live.
Eliminate them in our major urban cities and towns, that they no longer pose a threat.
We can draw a line and say, you know what, you stay out in the woods, we'll stay here, because the diseases that they're spreading, they will go away if the mosquito goes away for long enough. Because if we get better, like in America, we don't get malaria, hardly ever, because there's no one with malaria that a mosquito would bite and then give that malaria to someone else.
Oh.
We have a ton of Anopheles mosquitoes, and we have less than 1,000 cases of malaria a year. Almost all those cases are somebody like myself who gets sick in Africa, comes back here. Uh-huh. And why is that? Because we hit zero. Well, I mean, close to zero in our cities and towns. Once people stopped having malaria here, mosquitoes stopped getting it and giving it to other people.
We just have to kind of police the boundary a little bit better. The mosquitoes can still do their thing. Hmm. We can do our thing.
So you don't hate them anymore is what you're saying.
I think there's a way to live harmoniously with the mosquitoes. I mean, we do it in this country, right? I mean, we have mosquitoes and we control their populations in many ways, but we also get bit.
Special thanks to Andy Mills, of course, who learned bug tolerance through Radiolab.
Also, a very special thanks to David Baker, who went above and beyond in the pursuit of mutant mosquitoes. And also big thanks to writer Sonia Shaw.
But we are not yet done, because after the break, we have another story of another bug, which is not quite the curse on humanity that mosquitoes are, but this bug ends up being, for one particular woman, not merely a curse, but a curse with a little dash of blessing attached.
Yeah. We'll be right back.
This is Michael Burles from Portland, Oregon. Radiolab is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.
Radiolab is supported by Betterment. Let's talk about hustle culture. You know, the whole rise and grind, go big or go home thing. It's a lifestyle that may not be for you, but one that your money can handle thanks to Betterment. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. How? Their automated technology optimizes your investments again and again. With Betterment, your money is taking ice baths at 5 a.m. while you get your well-deserved rest. Your money downs protein smoothies and automatically reinvests your dividends. All before you head out the door. Your money is a workaholic, but you don't have to be, because you've got Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
Radiolab is supported by the John Templeton Foundation, funding research and catalyzing conversations that inspire people with awe and wonder. Learn about the researchers making the latest discoveries in the science of well-being, complexity, forgiveness, and free will at templeton.org/podcast.
Hey, Lulu here. You asked, and we listened. You wanted a Zuzve shirt, and we made one. It is a gorgeous celebration of the liminal being that is Venus's moon/not moon, and you yourself can sport this homage to the unknowable multitudes of those all around you and within you by simply joining The Lab. The Lab is our membership program that is the place where we fight the fight against the fickle whims of the economy to make our show protected from all that based on listener support. If you sign up, we thank you with the brand new Zuzve t-shirt and also ad-free episodes, bonus interviews, and other swaggy stuff like stickers and patches. You can go check out the perks and see if it's right for you by going to radiolab.org/join. And thank you either way for being here, for listening to our show. We make it for you, Zve. Anyway, radiolab.org/join. Check it out. And thanks.
Chad.
Robert.
Radiolab. For this next story, a much more personal tale of being haunted, not hunted, haunted by a bug.
Good. I'm getting, this is making me nervous. Maybe I should get my EpiPen.
Are you allergic to radio greatness?
Not that I know of. I haven't been really exposed to it yet. Anyway, let's go.
It starts with the conversation between Dan Pashman,
okay,
host of a podcast here at WNYC called The Sporkful. It's about food. And Amy Pearl.
Amy.
Yes.
A digital producer here at the station who likes food.
Mm.
And the conversation they had was about something that happened to Amy, which she never expected, certainly didn't want, and yet it could happen to any of us at any time.
So years ago, before any of this happened to you, just tell me, what was your relationship with meat?
Well, You know how when you're little and your mom is like, you can have any special dinner for your birthday. My dinner was meatballs. And she was like, except meatballs, they're so hard to make. So it was pot roast. And then Peter Luger's.
Famous steakhouse in Brooklyn.
Yeah. I used to go there quite often and I live there and I have a Peter Luger credit card. I was very into Peter Luger. I was living in Williamsburg and it opened at like 1 o'clock every day and you could just walk in at one. They had an amazing bar. There's no tablecloths on the table. These old German waiters. They bring out your porterhouse for three. They put a little plate upside down and then put the big platter on top of it so it's tilted and all the juice runs to the end. And then they like have this special double spoon thing that they somehow like scoop juice onto your steak. And oh, so good. And also like the smell of burning fat from a hamburger.
What about hot dogs?
Oh my God, I love hot dogs so much. Like having a weenie roast out in the open air. It's like, oh God, it's so good.
What changed?
Oh my God, it was terrible. What happened was I was having this beautiful, it was springtime. I was having a beautiful leg of lamb with some neighbors and we like put it on the grill and it was just a delicious, beautiful dinner. And I had served with it some ramps that I foraged in my mom's yard.
A ramp, by the way, is just a wild onion.
So we had this delicious meal. And then, you know, I went home and I was going to sleep at like midnight, like a few hours later. And I just felt weird. I was like, God, something's wrong. I feel like really anxious, like something's wrong with me. And I went in the bathroom and I like look in the mirror and my face was like all weird looking. And I was like, I kept laying down and be like, I'll just sleep it off, whatever it is. But every time I lay down, I felt like I was going to faint. So I was like, prop myself up. And I was like, oh God, I was having terrible like stomach cramps and just like a weird feeling of impending doom, you know, but just like anybody, I'm just like, just get a good night's sleep. This will pass. I like splash a little water on my face. I mean, I don't know what made me think this, but I thought like maybe a snail, a tiny snail was on one of the ramps that I ate and it was like poisoning me somehow. I called my friends in the morning. I was like, hey, how you guys doing? How was dinner? And they were like, oh, so great. And I was like, really? So great? Nothing weird? Like,
no horrific panic attacks?
They were like, oh, that was so lovely. Thank you so much. Let's do it again. Blah, blah, blah. And I was like, wow, I really had a rough night. But I didn't think anything of it. And I went on with my life, you know, just like, whatever. And then about a week or two later, I made some cheeseburgers and I ate a cheeseburger and I was watching Goodbye, Mr. Chips, really tear-jerking movie and a good book too. And about a couple of hours after I ate, I was like started to feel really weird. Again, I was like feeling like I was like had to stand up. I was like, I think I'm going to faint. I feel really lightheaded. I can't catch my breath. I feel like really woozy, but if any time I lay down, I really felt like I was going to faint. So I was like trying to stay sitting upright. And I was like, oh my God, this is very similar. I ran into the bathroom and I was like looking in the mirror and lo and behold, I had hives all over my stomach. And then they started coming out of my hands and I was like, oh my God, something's happening. And at one point I did get up and unlock my door because I did feel like I'm going to pass out, call an ambulance, and then they're not going to be able to get in. So, I mean, I was in a little bit afraid of what was happening. And when I woke up in the morning, the first thing I did was Google sudden meat allergy because I was like, this seems like an allergy. And the only thing that was the same was meat. And I'm going through and like the second thing that came up was this article that was like, Florida man has sudden meat allergy. I was like, oh my God, I think is it possible I could have this? And so I made an appointment with my doctor. I brought in the article. I'm like, I'm going to be this person, but I can do it. You know, the person who goes to their doctor with something I found on the internet. So I brought the article. It was in my pocket. And like, I was too chicken. When I was paying the receptionist, I pulled it out and gave it to the receptionist. And I was like, could you give this to the doctor? So that was like the best I could do. And then I did call my doctor and had a conversation with him on the phone asking him if I could get tested. And he was like, no, there's no such thing as a meat allergy, blah, blah, blah.
So some people think allergies are just like in your head.
Yeah.
This is science writer Peter Smith. We got in touch with him after we heard Amy's story because Peter is an investigator of many things, including strange allergies.
And people are like, mushrooms hurt them, or they think
Wi-Fi hurts them.
Yeah, or Wi-Fi hurts them. And I don't know.
And when our producer Latif Nasser and I got into the studio and we told him about Amy's story, he said,
yeah, all right,
I know exactly who you need to talk to.
Hello.
Yeah, hi.
Thomas Platts Mills.
This is Thomas Platts Mills. That's right.
How are you?
I'm very well.
Dr. Platts Mills is down at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. He's a professor and he works at an allergy clinic.
In an allergy clinic, we are constantly sifting through stories which not only you don't believe, but are actually nonsense. Simply.
And he told us in the last 10 years or so, he started hearing lots of stories just like Amy's.
Right.
Somebody shows up at the office convinced that they're allergic all of a sudden for no apparent reason to red meat. Every single time he heard the story, he would tell the patient exactly what Amy's doctor told her.
No.
No way.
No.
It's not possible. So what was wrong with these complaints, you know, in an orthodox medical way?
Oh, everything.
Everything.
Adults don't become allergic to something they've eaten for 40 years out of the blue, and certainly not red meat.
So you're basically saying to these patients, I think you must be making this up.
I don't use language like that. I say there.
I was trying to give you your inner voice.
There. Oh, you don't want to know what doctors are thinking in their inner voices. You know, you often think in the middle of an interview, is it possible that he's got, you know, some ghastly disease?
Mad cow.
Yeah, you know.
The point is that when he'd hear a story like Amy's, he just
didn't believe it.
But then everything changed. Thanks, oddly enough, to a cancer drug.
This new cancer drug called cetuximab.
In New York today, Martha Stewart was indicted on criminal charges relating to...
This is the very drug that got Martha Stewart in all that trouble for insider trading.
Remember that? I went to jail for 6 months?
Yeah. Anyway, very promising, exciting new drug. But then...
Doctors were giving people this injection, and they would just like end up on the floor of the doctor's office.
In shock?
Yeah, they would be in anaphylactic shock.
Their hearts would start beating faster, they'd get short of breath, they'd get stomach cramps. Their immune system would start to overreact to something new and alien that came in with the drug. Basically, a classic allergic reaction.
So the mystery lands on Thomas Platts Mills' desk.
Yes. So we were asked to look at cetuximab.
To see if they could figure out what was causing the reaction.
And he tests two groups of blood, a control sample and then people that have this allergy.
And he quickly zeroed in on a particular molecule, a sugar, that was part of the drug.
This sugar, galactose alpha-1-3 galactose, or alpha-gal.
Alpha-gal?
Yeah.
As in a particularly great lady?
Yeah. It's like alpha male, but alpha female didn't quite have a ring to it.
So
the alpha-gal.
Anyway, it seemed like alpha-gal was the culprit.
Yeah, and if you told me 4 years earlier that there's a whole lot of people out there who are allergic to this sugar, I'd have thought you were smoking, you know, vaping again.
Because not only does this sugar alpha-gal show up in the cancer drug, and this is where we get back to Amy, it also shows up in the blood of mammals.
All non-primate mammals.
So every time you eat
lamb
or
beef, goat, camel,
even
tripe
or
pig's kidneys,
you're also eating alpha-gal.
So I'm reading this article and it says like it's this thing called alpha galactase or alpha gal or whatever.
So it made no sense that someone like Amy, who'd been eating meat all her life, would suddenly somehow be allergic to alpha gal.
This was so stupid.
So one day,
it's getting to be barbecue season. I usually have like a couple of barbecues where I just do a whole pork butt and a brisket, and I was like very wanted to do that. And I was like, I'm just going to not eat meat and not even know. So I was like, forget it. My doctor will test me. I'm going to test myself. So I was like, I'm not going to do it alone. I'll do it with my mom, my poor mom. And so I went up to my mom's, and she's like really into food too. So she was like, oh, this is so exciting. I got 2 porterhouse steaks on sale at Stew's.
Wait, did you explain to her what you were testing?
Yeah, I did, because I had talked a little bit about it with her. So, like, fire up the grill, do the porterhouse. I even think I, like, Instagrammed it as a joke. Like, ha, 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 this might be the last time you hear from me. But, you know, we're having a nice summer day, just me and my mom having our steak. I only ate, like, a couple bites because I was slightly nervous. And I was like sitting in the grass with my dog and reading a book and trying to think like, do I feel normal? Which, try it, folks. It's hard to figure out when you start asking yourself, do I feel normal? Does this, am I breathing? Is my stomach hurt? Is something wrong? And I was like, after a while, I was like, ugh, I feel pretty good. And the neighbor came over and was like chatting with us. And it was in the middle of that conversation where I was like, I kind of feel like I have to go to the bathroom, but maybe I just have to go to the bathroom. So I went to the bathroom and I was sitting there and I was like, oh God, something feels bad. And then I was like, oh God, this is not right. Something's wrong. And I went in to get the Benadryl and I took the Benadryl and I went on my bed and in the guest room at my mom's, and I was like sitting on there and I was like, I just don't feel right. Oh, maybe I just take a deep breath. I'll just stand up. Maybe I'll just put my hands over my head like this. Oh, that does feel slightly better, I think. And then I was finally like, I think we should go to the hospital. And I went outside. I was like, Mom, I think you have to drive me to the hospital. She was like talking to her neighbor like, what? Oh my God, honey, what? Oh, let me go change my clothes. Change my clothes. Like, Mom, you know, she's not wearing the hospital level clothes. So I'm like, okay, hurry up, Mom. Mom, are you ready, Mom? And then I was like, while she was changing her clothes, I suddenly was like, oh my God, got my wallet out and my cell phone. And I like threw it towards my mom's bedroom door. And I was like, here's my insurance card. Call an ambulance. And I just like hit the floor. Whoa. Eventually, the ambulance arrives and I got stabilized. I was strapped to the thing. I was in the emergency room like they were shooting me full of, I don't know what, epinephrine and adrenaline. And the little like 12-year-old emergency room doctor runs in and he was like, I looked it up on the internet. AlphaGal. Fascinating. What? That's terrible. I've never heard of that. Could it be true? Yes, it's true. Like they're all having this discussion there. Then when I went back to my doctor after that, and I was like, hey, just get out of the emergency room because they tested me for alpha-gal and I'm allergic to meat.
So this is an allergy.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden you're looking at the, quote, crazies, and they're not so, quote, crazy anymore.
Absolutely. We suddenly had a blood test. And of course, what turned out is all these patients who'd been telling us this story were allergic to alpha-gal.
But it's still like a mystery.
Right. There are patients.
Thomas Platts Mills couldn't figure out why people like Amy, who had lived for 40 years eating porterhouse steaks at Peter Luger's with a credit card, why would she suddenly develop an allergy now?
So we were looking for anything that could explain it.
It could be a mold. It could be a nematode.
A worm or a fungus.
But then he looked again and noticed that all the people who had had bad reactions to the cancer drug,
they were in a particular area of the country. It was Virginia, North Carolina, Southern Missouri, Tennessee, Arkansas. No cases in Salt Lake City, no cases in Denver.
Just smatterings down the west coast. So he turned to his technician, Jake, and he said,
I said, you've got to Google every map you can find and say, what matches that area?
Creatures or diseases that appear wherever the allergy appears. So Jake starts Googling.
Googling and Googling and Googling. And
eventually he comes across a map that
matches where the cases are very beautifully. The maximum area for Rocky Mountain spotted fever.
So he made this little map and it's like the shaded dark areas of the country are places with Rocky Mountain spotted fever. And then there's like some stars where, you know, this allergy had appeared.
Yeah.
And they overlap.
Ah, very interesting.
And then all of a sudden, it clicks. Rocky Mountain spotted fever is a tick-borne disease.
This is the distribution of the Lone Star tick.
A little before this, it turns out an allergist down in Australia, Cheryl Van Noonan.
First name Cheryl, S-H-E-R-Y-L, Van Noonan, V-A-N, and then N-U-N-E-N. And I'm from the Tick-Induced Allergies Research and Awareness Center in Sydney, Australia.
She says she was now being visited by all kinds of people who claimed suddenly to be allergic to meat.
And whenever I take a history, so for example, I'd ask them, was there a family history of rhinitis, eczema, asthma, stinging insect allergy? And they say they've all been bitten by ticks.
When we started asking patients, we suddenly heard the stories just out the kazoo.
But at this point, Dr. Platts Mills, all he has is a map, some stories, and a hunch.
Right.
So
what does he do?
He decides to test it on himself.
Oh my God.
He sort of like denies that he did it intentionally.
I know I had no intention.
I mean, I think he also likes to walk and amble and think about things.
Right.
So he goes for a long walk along the Blue Ridge Mountains.
And I knew I wanted to be off trail because I'm actually rather allergic to humans.
So he's walking and walking and walking, and along the way, he bumps into a whole bunch of ticks.
And if you walk into a nest of those things...
Oh my God, this sounds like a nightmare.
Yeah, absolutely. I got 200 seed ticks.
Oh boy.
And then in November of that year, I was taken out to dinner, and the lamb chops were particularly delicious, and the French wine was delicious. And 6 hours later, I woke up covered in hives.
He's got an allergy to red meat.
All just because of a...
Tick bite.
Tick bite.
That's right.
We'll bite you right back after this.
Hi, this is Sarah calling from Asheville, North Carolina. Radiolab is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.
Radiolab is supported by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy. Radiolab is supported by Babbel. Sometimes self-improvement can feel like a pretty overwhelming journey. So what if this year you just got a tiny bit better every day? When you're learning a new language with Babbel, that's exactly what you're doing. Babbel is a science-backed language learning app with quick 10-minute lessons that have been handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. You can learn everything you need to have real-world conversations, café s'il vous plaît, from vocabulary words to culture and more. And if Babbel can help you start speaking a new language in just 3 weeks, imagine what you could do in a few months or a full year. Here is a special limited-time deal for Radiolab listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/radiolab. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/radiolab, spelled BABBEL.com/radiolab. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Chad.
Robert.
Radiolab.
Now we go back to Amy. Just when she's discovered that the allergy to meat that she's developed comes from a tick bite.
A tick bite? Hang on a second. Because, like, a few weeks before all this started happening, as I said, I was foraging for ramps in my mom's backyard, and I had a tick on my arm.
Now, it turns out that not only was that tick bite a terrible thing for Amy, it was a kind of double tragedy.
Hidden from view amongst the trees and in the undergrowth.
And I think it's only right at this point to back up.
Is a fascinating world of wonders.
And consider the story from the tick's point of view.
Okay, so I'm Graham Hickling. I'm a wildlife disease ecologist at the University of Tennessee.
So I was wondering if you could help us tell the story of, in this case, the Lone Star tick, that bit Amy.
Oh, yeah, sure. So they start off in this little pile of eggs, perhaps a mass of 2,000 eggs, under the leaves.
The proud mom who just gave birth.
At that point, she's just a kind of a withered husk.
Meaning dead. But anyway.
A few weeks later, those eggs will hatch, and this mass of 2,000 baby ticks emerge from under the leaves.
And could I see them with my naked eye?
If you ran into a mass of them all up together, you would feel like you've got a little smudge of dirt, and then the dirt starts walking. And so they'll just climb up, and they'll, you know, potentially all be on the same leaf or the same twig, looking for something to feed on.
Now, one teeny little tiny problem for these teeny little tiny ticks
is that they dry out.
So when they come up from under the leaves, they come up
briefly,
and then they go back down, get a little water, come back up, get thirsty, go back down,
and rehydrate.
So they like commute.
Exactly. And we refer to the behavior as questing.
Oh, questing.
So if you were one of these little baby ticks up questing for food,
while you're up there, you are essentially Velcro.
Because on each one of your little legs,
you have little kind of hook-like structures, and so you're flat against the leaf.
Sort of sniffing in the air with your two little front legs.
That can detect CO2 heat movement.
So let's say one day you're sitting there on your leaf, and you pick up the scent of a nearby mouse.
Mice are the potato chips of the ecosystem. Everything eats them.
Which means you might be about to have your very first meal. So you
basically stand up,
stretch out all your little legs,
and do a tick dance. And so it's kind of interpretive dance-like movements.
And while you're waiting for that mouse to come just close enough that you can grab onto it. So you're dancing and you're waiting, and you're dancing and you're waiting, and you're dancing and you're waiting, and you're dancing and you're waiting.
To be honest, you are probably going to wait your entire life and die unfulfilled because there are 2,000 of you starting off and a stable tick population. There's only going to be two of you that survive.
Oh, my gosh. So 1,998 little baby ticks are born.
And then that's it for them.
But let's say that you're one of the lucky ones. And one sunny day, there you are hanging out on your little leaf when you detect two incoming mammals. One is a 40-year-old hominid, the other is her dog. So you perk up, you thrust your legs out.
Wave, do the tick dance.
And say that you're waving and you're dancing and you're hoping and you're waving and you're dancing and you're hoping and you're waving and you're dancing and you're hoping. And slowly the dog's getting closer and closer and closer. And you reach out with one of your tiny little limbs so you can grab on. And eat and survive. But
the reason that tick ended up on me was I slept in bed with my dog naked.
But how do you know that's when it happened?
Because I know that, like, I did a good tick check on myself and I took a shower and everything. And then in the middle of the night, I woke up with a itching sensation and I went to the bathroom and I couldn't really see what was on, like something was on the back of my arm and it was a tick.
So as the tick is biting into Amy, what is it giving Amy that's going to make her allergic to meat?
Well, I need to stop you there, Robert.
Difficult one, Robert.
I don't know the answer to that.
That's Peter Smith, and rejoining us is Cheryl Van Noonan, the scientist.
It's all up for speculation.
We don't really know. But here's the theory.
So normally, when you eat a piece of meat, you put alpha-gal in your stomach, and your stomach digests it, and it's in your body, and it's no big deal.
But the tick cunningly
will drill into you, poke into you,
and injects
its saliva.
We'll call that tick spit.
Tick spit into its victims.
Straight into its victim's largest organ.
The skin.
And tick spit has an anti-clotting factor, an anesthetic, anti-inflammatory compounds.
And
we think
the alpha-gal.
Now, Peter says the thing about the skin is
the skin is like this enormous, like, surveillance system.
It's always on the lookout for invaders. So when the alpha-gal comes through your skin, covered by all that bad, bad tick spit stuff,
that's going to really, like, set off your immune system.
The immune system freaks out.
Like, oh.
And the alpha-gal, covered now in bad spit, almost sort of
by mistake,
gets labeled bad. And now it's on the bad guy watch list. So,
therefore,
the next time you eat meat,
the meat comes in.
And then
the body unleashes wave upon wave upon wave of chemical attacks
to do battle against this alpha-gal.
And this reaction gets way out of hand. You got so many antibodies multiplying, 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 making you, rather in this case, Amy, feel just horrible.
Right.
I mean, it's very weird. It sounds like a science fiction movie. It sounds like the beginning of a science fiction, at least kid's book. It's just strange.
Which all goes to say that this really is a kind of double tragedy for Amy and her tick.
Yeah, because ticks didn't evolve to bite humans.
Right. We're a mistake.
Like, we have opposable thumbs.
We're either going to pull them off.
I actually woke my mom up and she helped get it off.
Or if they drop off, they're going to drop off in an airport terminal or a Walmart car park or somewhere like that.
Or a shag carpet.
Or a shag carpet indoors, and they're doomed.
And for us, well, we lose something that historically anyway is a big part of who we are.
Yeah. Because we adapted in the grand evolutionary scheme of things to like eat flesh, to eat meat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm actually sitting here picturing a steak, but actually the thing, I mean, hot dogs like wrap ramps around a weenie and roast. Yum, that sounds so good. My mouth's watering. Weenies and ramps.
Yeah.
But I am going to my allergist tomorrow because I did, you know, I was reading about this allergy a lot when I first got it. And I read that for some people, the allergy can fade away. So I'm going to get a blood test to see what my blood level of alpha-gal is. So I'm a little...
So what are you hoping for tomorrow?
I want to be normal. Again.
That was the end of the Dan and Amy conversation. She was going to go to the doctor, get herself tested, find out whatever. So we asked her back in.
Okay.
To find out what happened.
So I actually did get an appointment with my allergist. So I got the appointment, I got the blood draw, whatever. And a few days later, my doctor called me and she said that my numbers were still really high. And I was like, well, how high are they? And she was like, 3. And I was like, 3? That's not high. And she's like, they're supposed to be like 1 or something. So they had gone down, but they were still, you know, many times more than they should be. So,
but when you left and you were waiting for the call, were you waiting with the hope that that you would soon be eating a bit of hot dog?
I mean, honestly, I was hoping no.
No?
No. I don't.
Wait a second. You are the big, the great, you.
No, but I was afraid that she would be like, oh my God, your numbers are so low. I think you could probably eat meat. Let's do a food challenge. I would be like, ah, because like, that's such a scary memory. Yeah, I don't, you know, actually just the other night I was eating at an Indian place and I was eating vegetarian, but like, I felt something and I pulled it out, and in the dim light of an Indian restaurant, like, why are they all lit like that? I was like, was this bacon? And I suddenly, you know, like you just get this drop in your stomach and I'm like, what time is it? 4 hours from now, if I, you know, because it's, there's something about it being delayed that makes it so difficult. It just is like.
Like a suspense movie with you, the victim.
It's like it could happen in the next 3 hours or maybe not. I don't know. The real reason I want to be able to eat meat is so that I will be prepared to eat it in case of emergency. I mean, I went on a canoe trip in the Adirondacks and I was like, well, what happens if I get stranded out here? And like, what if I have to hunt, but I can't even eat meat? I would have to hunt fish. But then when the lake freezes over, what would I eat? I can't survive. Something's wrong with me. I feel evolutionarily challenged. This is what I think about before I go to bed every night. Would I be able to survive if I had just what's on me right now? It's not a real issue. Obviously, it's never going to happen. I live in Brooklyn. But I do, for some reason, I always think, like, I want to be prepared in case. But I don't think I would go back to eating meat necessarily.
Like, you are still more frightened than game, so to speak.
Well, also, like, I wish I could be a vegetarian for ethical reasons because it's the factory farming and that kind of stuff. So I feel like morally superior now. I can be like, well, I don't eat red meat. Of course, I'm forced to not eat it, but at the same time, I would if I had the willpower, I'd probably go that way anyway. And then also, I think it's great. It's like we're all evolving to be on this planet, which is getting harder to be on. And we know that meat takes a lot of resources. And like, now I'm not doing that. So like, the tick is helping me evolve into a better human being.
Like, so one could, instead of thinking of the tick as your teeny weeny irritating enemy, you could think of it as a guiding light, making the world safer to share with your fellow earthlings.
Yeah.
So you may have lost your relationship with meat, but At least you have your moral superiority.
Yeah, I mean, I am superior. Yeah.
So, huge thanks to Amy Pearl for telling a story which never stopped being scary and wonderful. And to the fellow who brought her into the room, Dan Pashman, whose podcast, The Sporkful, is all about food in every conceivable way. Like, he talks about eating it, preparing it, worrying about it, as you've heard, getting sick from it, getting fat from it, whatever. And you can find his show on iTunes or Stitcher or on the internet at sporkful.com. And this story was produced by Annie McEwen and Matt Kilty with reporting help from Latif Nasser.
We should say, since we did the show, there's been a lot more attention given to this tick and the consequences of its bite.
There have been stories in the Times, the New York Times, and in USA Today, and a study from the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases that has gone and found that some cases of unexplained anaphylaxis can be caused by allergy to alpha-gal.
Yeah, these would be bites by the Lone Star tick.
Okay, we have spent so much time in this hour beating up on bugs, it's time to simply flip and understand that these are creatures on Earth, many more of them than there will ever be of us.
They're winning.
And they're winning.
They're winning.
So it's only right and only fair to give them a little bit of love. And a couple of years ago, I sat down with maybe one of the greatest insect lovers I have ever met. His name was Tom Eisner. He taught up at Cornell University. He figured out how all kinds of animals, little itty-bitty ones, talk to each other, make love to each other, make war with each other, struggle with each other. I think he taught us more about insects than maybe anybody I know. We spoke at the 92nd Street Y in Manhattan.
Your interest in insects, can you remember when it began?
According to my parents, when I first stood on my feet.
Really?
All I cared about was bugs. Indeed. Beetles, caterpillars, ants, termites, cockroaches. I picked them up. I learned quickly not to put them all in my mouth. I kept them in my room. My room was a zoo.
You were born in Berlin.
Correct.
From a Jewish family.
Mm-hmm.
You were about 3 years old when you left, or thereabouts?
3 years old. Went to Spain.
So you went from the Nazis in Berlin to Spain.
Yes, in the Spanish Civil War, fled for France. My parents decided we should really start somewhere else, and we went to South America. And that was an entomological paradise. Every living organism has some sort of odor. You can build these up in your memory. And I used to take a whiff of an insect and classify them in my mind's eye according to what they smelled like. Caterpillar, ant, beetle.
And do you ever dream of insects?
Yeah, I tend to dream that I am an insect.
What does that mean, that you dream that you are an insect? I mean, you scurrying and
yes,
walking upside down on the ceilings? Or
indeed, even escaping swattings. The weirdest situation that I ever got into in a dream was I dreamed that I was an insect, and I was telling another insect that I occasionally dream that I'm a human.
That's your meta dream.
Insects were somehow my great love. I was very much a loner, and if I didn't have a room full of insects live, I was unhappy.
No, Tom, I wanted to ask you.
And at this moment, Oliver Sacks, who was on the stage with us, he asked Tom this question.
Whether you feel that insects respond to you, you know, whether you feel them sort of purring, and whether they know that you're gentle and reliable, and for them.
Yeah, you know, it's a good question. I don't presume to read responses on the part of the insects. But the older I get, the more difficult I find it to experiment with them, and there are ways that kill them. Bombardier beetles can live for 1, 2, up to 3 years in your lab. You become very attached to them. You give them names. And when they die, it's an event. So you must somehow have moments where you feel that things are going on in that tiny little brain, that they have secrets hidden up their sleeves, that they might reveal if you found a common language. I find that I can love nature no matter how distant the individual organisms are from me. But I reach out and hope that I can shorten the distance and create some feeling of coexistence.
Tom Eisner's book is called For the Love of Insects.
That's really what it's called?
Yeah.
Well, we should go. Check our website, radiolab.org, for more information. And you can always send us an email at radiolab@wnyc.org.
Radiolab is one word.
Yes, it is. I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
Thanks for listening.
Received Thursday at 9:50 p.m.
This is Dan Pashman from the Sporkful Podcast.
Hi, this is Amy Pearl. I'm allergic to meat.
And I'm Susie Von Eggers, Amy Pearl's mom. Radio Lab is produced by Jad Abumrad. Dylan Keefe is our director of sound design.
Doran Wheeler, senior editor.
Jamison York is our senior producer.
Our staff includes Simon Adler,
Brenna Farrell,
David Gable,
Matt Kielty,
Robert Krulwich,
Annie McEwen,
Latif Nasser,
Melissa O'Donnell,
Ariane Wack, and Molly Webster.
With help from Tracy Hunt,
Niger Fatali,
Phoebe Wang,
Katie Ferguson,
Alexandra Lee Young,
W. Harry Portuna,
and Persia Verlin. All right, that's like all the options I could come up with.
Our fact-checkers are Eva Dasher.
And Michelle Harris.
Yeah, all right, I think I got that one.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
Good night.
End of message.